Need to drink options, ingredients for craft cocktails, gifts, and more, ladysippers.com.
KAXE receives support from the Pines Restaurant, hosting a one-year anniversary block party Saturday, June 27th from noon until 10 p.m., featuring live music from Diddy Wish, Sam Miltich, and Tattletale. Local vendors, food and cocktails, and a celebration of downtown Grand Rapids. More information at pinesmn.com.
Tornado Bob's going to be coming up in this next hour. We're also going to be continuing our series, Critters That Live in Dead or Decaying Trees. And today, taking a look at bees and wasps. Then at 9 o'clock, it is Malachi Coons for Headwaters. Going to be partly sunny today, high 67 to 72 with northwest winds 10 to 20. Chance of showers tonight, mostly cloudy, temperatures in the mid-40s to low-50s, and west winds from 5 to 20 miles an hour. And a good chance for showers with possible thunderstorms tomorrow, highs in the low to mid-60s.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We operate translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Since 1976, Northern Community Radio has been telling the stories of the people and the land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. Keep KAXE people powered into the future with your support now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you.
Some things going on in our region. The Tuesday Summer Concert Series continues in Grand Rapids today at noon. Percussionist Brady Kaysen and friends are performing at Grace Bible Church. And Brainerd Community Theater is presenting Aladdin Jr. That's today through the 18th and then the 20th of June at the Chalberg Theater on the campus of Central Lakes College. Tickets at clcperformingarts.com. And then the Virginia Public Library, they have a Rubik's Cube tournament coming up tomorrow at 3 p.m. One champion will rise above the rest.
If I started the day, I might get one side by that time tomorrow.
We're doing the Rubik's Cube on the bus, and then I got the book that told you how to make it, so I like memorized the book so I could do it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I couldn't quite.
Have you actually done it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I've never been successful. Never.
I somehow thought like maybe 5-6 years ago, it was like somehow, maybe that stuck with me. No. I mean, I can do a few sides, but the memorization bus thing went away.
My brain didn't function on that one. but then it came along when I was probably 40 or 45 years old, and I wasn't really, into puzzles at that time. I was busy raising a family and building a house and that sort of thing. So didn't have a lot of time to just sit down and fool around with a block of plastic.
There's going to be a send-off for two Bemidji Special Olympians as they head to the U.S. Games to compete in bowling. You can join them on Thursday with a program at Lucky Dogs at 11:30, followed by a gathering at the Paul and Babe statues at 12:30.
The National Special Olympics are being held in Minnesota, Minneapolis area. Huh. And I noticed there was a call out for volunteers a while ago. And I wanted to go, but it wasn't going to fit in my schedule. But I think if you happen to be in the cities and you're nearby to one of these events, you should attend. You will not be disappointed. And probably you won't go away dry-eyed. Donating stocks and mutual funds is a quick, easy way to support KAXE's future. You may receive tax benefits as well. You can call Sarah for details. The number is 218-326-1234.
The Festival Rialto was over the weekend. We're going to hear some music from one of the performers who was there, but we want to let you know there's also so many other opportunities to see live music in our region, and that includes on Saturday, June 27th, KAXE KBXE is partnering with Bridget's Pub in Keg and Cork to host the Beltrami Block Party in downtown Bemidji. It'll be free live music with Eric Koskinen, David Huckfeldt, Little Fevers, and more, as well as food and beverages on Beltrami Avenue. Information at KEXE's Facebook page, and it's made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets at 12:30 p.m. Monday, June 22nd on Zoom. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org or call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month. The board's meeting schedule is available at kaxe.org.
We're going to take a listen now to Kelly Smith. She's a Brainerd folk and old-time musician. And these are some live recordings from a video series called Rhino Sessions. It's not an official release, but the good folks at Rhino were kind enough to send us their recordings.
That's more than I can bear. The birds, they greet the day with songs of old, songs they hold for those bowed alone. They fly free just like a sign for you and me that this gravity will give way someday, someday. From dust we come, and Lord, to dust we will return. The peace, the pain of every season's change. Seems like yesterday your hand was warm in mine, and now you slipped through my fingers. Oh, it's not that I am afraid for you. You'll be light and I'll be blue. 'Cause I can't recognize a world without your smile. It's not the same, and it'll take a little time. From dust we come, and Lord, in dust we will return. Peace, the pain of every season's change. It seems like yesterday your hand was warm in mine, and now you slip through my fingers. Oh.
This is the Up North Look Back, where we're digging into the local news archives from 1976, the year KAXE was born. I'm Chelsea Perkins. It's the week of June 15th. A state of emergency was declared by President Ford in mid-June 76 in 40 Minnesota counties where crops were severely damaged by drought. The counties were mostly in the western and central areas of the state, including Cass, Crow Wing, and Beltrami. The president of the National Ayrshire Breeders Association said cattle herds already had been cut beyond normal, and consumers could expect to pay higher prices for milk, butter, and cheese because of the drought. A spokesman for the Federal Disaster Assistance Administration said the federal aid would include funds for transportation of hay to drought-stricken areas for dairy and beef cattle. A wall of a condemned Aiken school building from 1901 collapsed onto another part of the school while being demolished in June of 76. The wall fell onto a section of the school that was built in 1965. It crashed through the roof of two classrooms. No one was injured, but the demolition workers were then trying to figure out how to finish the demolition without more damage. Members of the Grand Rapids School Board had some discussion in June of 76 about teacher recruitment. Some felt too many teachers were being hired from Bemidji State University and that there should be a wider recruitment of teachers. Dr. Bob Volker was asked why he was recommending a candidate from State University College in New York. He responded by saying, "New York is about as far away as we could get." The teacher in question, however, already lived in the area. The Crosby City Council on June 14, 1976, heard a report from Frank Perpich regarding a survey he had made of trees with Dutch elm disease on city property. Perpich said there were far more diseased trees than anticipated in the city park, in the Franklin School area, and along some boulevards. The trees were marked and would be removed, city officials said. It was not yet determined how many trees on private property were also affected. Several boats were floating unattended June 17, 1976 in Pekegama Lake after some high winds. Most were claimed by their owners, but the owners were not found and no registration existed for a sailboat and a fiberglass canoe. The Itasca County Sheriff's Office was asking the boat owners to contact them. A 75-cent increase for garbage pickup was approved by the Grand Rapids City Council in mid-June 76. The increase raised the cost from $4.25 to $5. For the $5 fee, two garbage cans would be emptied twice a week. The increase was said to be needed due to rising costs since the last raise was approved in 1973. Meanwhile, the Bemidji Pioneer reported on the first recycling pickup trial in the U.S. The EPA trial was in two Massachusetts cities, and residents sorted their garbage between paper, glass, metal, and other waste. A separate truck would pick up their recycling from the homes. The piece was titled "Environmental Good News in Garbage." The Grand Rapids High School varsity debate team lost in the fifth round of the national tournament in Colorado Springs. Out of over 100 teams that went to the national tournament, only 30 made it to the fifth round. The Grand Rapids Herald described the coach Merlin R. Botter as looking like a young Santa Claus. Eugene Bradfield received the Rose and J. Phillip Award as one of five outstanding handicapped Minnesotans in 1976. Bradfield was a professor of psychology and a counselor at Bemidji State University. He became blind as a teenager. The award came with a $300 gift. The Brainerd Dispatch reported on the results of On Wheels Day, a special recreation event for youngsters in Brainerd that June of 76. Children competed in fastest bike and coasting in multiple age groups. Jason Franzen won the fastest trike, and Mark McDonald won the wheelbarrow race. Northland news outlets displayed numerous Father's Day 1976 specials. Quadna was offering a Ranchero outdoor barbecue. A $6 prime rib of beef Father's Day special was offered at the Harbor in Grand Rapids. Dads could skate for free at Nisswa Roller Arena. And the Brainerd Elks Dining Room offered a $1.50 Father's Day brunch. Thanks to the archives of the Bemidji Pioneer, Brainerd Dispatch, and the Grand Rapids Herald Review. As these local stories unfolded 50 years ago, KAXE was getting its start. Keep People Powered Radio going into the future in northern Minnesota with your support now at KAXE.org.
50 ways to leave your lover. You just slip out the back, Jack.
It's 8:14. You're tuned into People Powered KAXE. And yes, indeed, celebrating 50 years of community radio.
Yeah.
All this year, we'll be hearing more things from our archive and all kinds of great stuff in the year ahead. We've got a membership drive coming up in July, and if you haven't yet become a member, it's a great time to do it. You can do it anytime, but now do it from now until when we begin, and it gets counted right in there. You can text the word donate, 218-326-1234. You keep stories like what you just heard, like reports on nature. We got a text in from Bob And he says that, he says, good morning, Heidi and John. The Snapper Maternity Ward was busy here on our peninsula on Grand Lake. He's in Twig.
Okay.
And he sent a whole series of photos. It's great. He said, I think there were 12.
Wow.
Just like you said last week, they came to lay eggs when it rains. Thanks for the great show this morning.
Yeah. Thank you, Bob. And thanks for bringing us up to date on the turtles. Mm-hmm. I have not seen many painted turtles in my yard. Last week, Tuesday, was, I think, the last day that I had one in my yard or on the road coming into my house. And so I just, part of it is I've become a lot less mobile. I don't drive as much as I used to. And so there's often days during the week where two or three days will pass and I'll not have left the house. I mean, I've left the house. I haven't gotten in a car and gone anywhere. And so I miss out on a lot of that stuff, but I still think that they're not very active right now. And I think part of it is the fact that it is still very dry. We receive support from Bratton Tree Care, located in Grand Rapids, providing quality service to the Minnesota Northland. With 5 years' experience and an ISA arborist on staff, Bratton Tree Care is able to handle all your tree service needs. Learn more at brattontreecare.com.
It's time to talk weather. You're just talking about how dry it is, and we do have some rain in our forecast. We saw some rain coming up, so it's time for Big Weather Picture from Tornado Bob. He's joining us in the studio. Morning, Bob.
Good morning, Heidi.
Morning, Bob.
Morning, John.
Yeah, I expect less than your best because we were out of coffee when you got here, and so we'll take the second string today.
I'm not going to give you any rain.
You go. Oh, dang.
I just went and put a pot on, so midway through he's going to get some. So
oh, good, good.
Well, right. Maybe you'll get rain next year then.
Oh, these meteorologists, I'll tell you, once you give them control of the weather, all bets are off. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, we had the threat of rain overnight yesterday afternoon about 6 o'clock or 6:30. It looked like it might rain a little bit. And I got up this morning and there was raindrops on my windshield, but
congratulations on getting raindrops on your windshield.
No kidding.
Yeah.
I ran the wipers and collected the runoff and dumped it on my plants.
Okay. That's way to go.
Yeah.
I think on my next storm chase, I'll be going back and getting into areas of the high plains that are a little bit more arid. Hope to bring some cactus back so I can plant them in my front yard.
Yeah.
And they'll probably grow here now.
I'm thinking.
Summers are way drier than they used to be. So.
Yeah. I've got this plant called Maiden Pink, and it grows out in the middle of the field along the fence row, and the field is just, I mean, it's basically sand. There's a bit of brown, you know, mineral or non-mineral soil on top, but only a few inches, and this stuff is out right in the, there is not a speck of shade unless the barbed wire fence counts as shade. And that stuff just does really well. And this year it's doing very, very well. I was thinking of digging up a patch and bringing it and putting it in a part of my yard that is perennially so dry that when I mow the lawn, I rarely go there. It just doesn't need it.
Yeah, the only thing that happens is you raise a cloud of dust.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So I was considering this morning and didn't actually get around to making the calculations because it was time to leave the house and come to KAXE. But I consider the summers are, since 2020, the summers have been dry.
Yep.
2021 was very dry. 2023 was very dry. 2024 ended up being, started out with a, you know, kind of a heavy rainfall, heavy wet June, 6 inches in June, which is inch and a half, 2 inches above average.
Yeah.
And then the rest of that year was dry. The rest of that summer was dry. So we ended up with like 9 inches that summer. And then the last summer was just like dry. So,
yeah. And I'd forgotten that it was 2 years since we had that 6 inches of rain in June, but
yeah,
it is. It's 24 that happened. So yeah,
yep. That's probably the last month above average for a summer month since you have to go back to 2020. And that year we had really quite a wet summer, ended up close to Well, I have to go back and look at the numbers, but they're like in the upper teens.
So more than average.
Yeah, more than average.
Yeah.
And our average should be somewhere like 11 and a half or maybe close to 12.
And we're talking what?
For the whole summer.
May, June,
July, August.
Okay, just what you would call the meteorological summer. Yep.
And we haven't come very close to that since 2020.
Wow.
I think the closest we've got, I'll have to go back and look at mine. Maybe I'm forgetting something, but it seems like the most we can get now is like 9 since then.
Yeah.
So what I did is consider the fact that, okay, if you just assume there's nothing going on more deterministically with the climate that's causing that to happen, just assume you just get a random, your summer precipitation is just sort of randomly varying. What is the probability that you would get that many dry years in a row? So like, that's like assuming it's going to be, it's only 5 years in a row. So if you say like half, 5 years in a row are going to be below average, below the median, then that is, 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5 times 0.5. Those 5 years in a row that would be, below average. It's like the odds are kind of small that be.
It gets to be a little number.
Not that that's, and you say like, yeah, it's kind of a, and then you add a sixth one, it's like you cut it in half again. So we'll see. It seems like the odds of so many dry summers in a row, if there's nothing going on, are rather small. But
is there some overall weather pattern that's shifting? I mean, or is the summer what would have been normal? Has it moved to somewhere else, or has the conditions?
The only things I can think of that would be related to anything that's, climate related would be that the Western U.S. is drying out. And when you dry out landscapes, what would have basically partially gone to latent heat and moisture is actually going to sensible heat. And sensible heat has a more direct impact on atmospheric circulation patterns. And the Rockies are a major component of the atmospheric circulation over North America. So if you warm it up in the West more than you warm it up in the East, what you're going to do in the summertime is build upper level ridging. So the flow is either going to be, and you see this during the summer, it's kind of the case anyway, because it's kind of the summer gets to this sort of flow anyway, where there's a lot of upper level ridging in the Southwest and Southwestern U.S., and it will spread into the South Central U.S. And for us, mid to late summer, there's no, you either get two types of ridge type patterns. Either there's going to be a sharper ridge in the Western U.S. And then east of that, then you get northerly flow and we get our cooler conditions. Or if you get some case where you have disturbances crashing into that ridge and they tend to spread that ridge farther east across the central U.S. And those are the cases where we get more kind of warm and humid conditions. So those are the two possibilities that we generally normally get. In the summertime, it seems like we're getting if we're getting more of that case where it's warm and humid, you would think, well, God, there's more moisture associated with that. But a lot of these warm, humid events, what happens is in that pattern, it shifts rainfall more towards the places that are convectively, I don't know, you get more, it shifts the rainfall more towards stuff, nighttime, and early morning mesoscale convective systems. These thunderstorm complexes that develop out of the Dakotas, they roll down Interstate 94 towards the cities. Just the way the landscape works around here is it directs the storms, it directs the moisture and the dynamics for storms to occur a little south of here. But that doesn't mean that that southern Minnesota isn't also a little bit dry too, but they've not been as dry in the last couple of years as we have. And you'll see, if you look at the drought monitor in Minnesota, you'll see north central Minnesota is really dry.
Yeah.
Is the dry.
Yeah.
We're in severe drought. It just, and we haven't been, you know, the, a lot of the moisture has fallen south of here.
I know we've done this before, and I apologize, but I know we have new listeners all the time. Can you explain, well, first of all, latent and sensible heat, and then ridges. Can you sort of put those into terms that someone who's not familiar with weather would maybe be able to grasp what it is we're talking about?
Yeah, so upper ridges, I'm talking about high pressure. And I'm talking about ridge. When you look at weather maps and what meteorologists look on weather maps, if you're looking at the upper level flow, that's just sort of we call it upper level because it's above where we are, above ground level by quite a bit.
Right.
Those tend to look like more like rivers. If you look at the lines of constant pressure, or you can. We have different
isobars.
Isobars.
Okay.
We use different. We actually use different variables for that. We use like lines of constant height, and the height at which the pressure drops to exactly 500 millibars.
Or okay.
About what half of what it is at the ground.
Okay.
Roughly. So we look at things in different coordinate systems, and what basically you look like on a map, you see a bunch of lines. You see some place where the lines are going farther north. And that's when there's more upper level high pressure, and we call those ridges. And then the lines come back south, and you're looking on the map, and north is oriented up on the map.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at those when those lines dip down, they'll say, oh, well, that's a trough.
Ah, so, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So we're looking at ridges and troughs. Ridges are basically upper level high pressure, kind of fair weather, warmer atmosphere in general.
Essentially, what we're having, clear skies. Yeah. Not a lot of clouds, just kind of.
Yeah, you can also have a trough with clear skies in it, but
damn,
a lot of times.
I was hoping we could keep it simple, Bob.
The atmosphere isn't quite that simple. It's more simple than say like biology.
Oh, really?
I think it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So ridges are upper level high pressure, usually clear skies, warm conditions. And then as far as latent heat goes, latent heat is when you're evaporating, latent heat is basically associated with phase changes of water. So if you have sunlight reaching the ground and you've got dry ground, all that energy is going to creating heat, okay? If you have sunlight and it's wet ground, a portion of that energy is going to evaporating water, and the temperature doesn't get as warm. It will feel more humid in those conditions, like if there's more water vapor in the air, but the actual temperature is cooler. You only notice the difference if you start to sweat, and your sweat doesn't evaporate, you feel hotter.
Right.
That's the latent heat. You're using, when you sweat, you're taking advantage of latent heat exchange. So you're evaporating water off your skin. It cools you off. So that's the latent heat component. It's associated with phase changes of water. When you evaporate water, you're losing heat.
Heat has to be given off.
Yep. And if it condenses on you, you're getting sensible heat back, conversion from latent heat to sensible heat again.
Okay.
That's what happens in clouds, why thunderstorms are, unstable, why thunderstorms, the heat air rises. Once you get condensation in clouds, that adds hot air, or that adds heat during that process. It's latent heat that just converted back to sensible heat, and you're adding, making that parcel
buoyant
again. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Anyhow,
I don't mean, I know that you and I have talked about this, and I'm pretty clear on it now, but I know there are a lot of listeners who tune in, and some of these terms are sort of just a little bit over their heads because they don't have they haven't learned the vocabulary. So, thank you.
So, you learn it may be drying out here because the weather patterns that are give us drier conditions are becoming more common.
Yeah.
Related to like maybe a bit more ridgy in the west, more of a ridge. And then So I think the conditions that give us the most rainfall is if you have a little bit more trough in the west and or overhead, we just have upper level low pressure. And we have these unsettled conditions with more showery weather. These aren't the ones with thunderstorms or something. We don't tend to get a lot of rain and thunderstorms here. Like if you hear thunder, you're probably going to get just a few drops and that's it.
Yeah.
Around here, that we don't get the mesoscale convective systems that get farther south quite so much.
Uh-huh,
I mean,
okay.
they happen occasionally, but if you look at big complexes of thunderstorms with a big heavy rain, wind in the front of them, and it rains like a half inch or an inch, and then that passes by and you get this longer period of like just lighter rain, and it gradually, those sorts of, that's a mesoscale convective system. It's just a big complex of thunderstorms, and they are really pretty uncommon. They're way more common in the southern part of Minnesota than they are in northern Minnesota, and we haven't had a lot of those actually even in southern Minnesota. I haven't seen those much this year.
Yeah.
Anyhow, so
I know yesterday while I was watching out the window as the rain approached, I noticed, and I'll probably get the term wrong, but I think cumulonimbus, they were cumulus clouds that were piling up and bubbling up. I mean, you could see them rising up.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen a lot of that, but it's a bit like a watering can. It's sort of like, it's not a giant fire hose. It's just a watering can goes over, and it like at my house, I don't think it rained 0.02 inches.
Yeah.
There was
nothing. They are not around here. They are not very efficient precipitation producers.
Mm.
You see them, it's coming by, it's raining in a square mile area, but you know, maybe they get a 10th or inch of, or 0.2 inches. And then like the rest of your own, like square 10 mile, like 100, you know, like most of the neighborhood is just not getting much from maybe a sprinkle or maybe nothing.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the way the thunderstorms work around here. But we have a day when it's just a steady rain, then that's going to be producing more rainfall than just a isolated thunderstorm case. Even though a thunderstorm locally could drop, you know, an inch.
Yeah.
Well,
to that point,
the coverage is so small on the thunderstorms. So, anyway,
Mark.
So when I saw that yesterday, it was just showery and maybe a thunderstorm or two. I thought like, no, it's not going to rain that much.
Yeah. Well, it certainly didn't.
Yep. And so
we're holding you at fault. So, you know, we've lined up.
It's always my fault.
There's like 40 people standing outside with clubs ready to beat you on your way to your bicycle. So.
Yeah, okay.
It's your fault.
I'll make sure I sneak out the back.
He's looking at his bike. rain tomorrow, though?
So, that...
Depends. What do you got for me?
I can go through what I looked at. I think this next system is looking like it's going to be a fairly... maybe a 50 to 75 or maybe even 100-mile wide band of half inch or greater rainfall. It could fall from maybe along Highway 2 to between Highway 2 and Highway 210, likely.
That would be the greatest amounts.
Yeah, but if that shifts, it's like now I'm kind of going back into snowstorm mode. Usually the probability of it falling exactly in that band seems like it could shift southward and then we get almost nothing. Up along the Canadian border, the forecast amounts are pretty much zero. And then, but most of the state gets some, like maybe a quarter inch. So, or as low as a 10th of an inch. But so I'd say maybe a 10th of an inch. Just expect a 10th or
all right,
maybe a quarter if you're lucky. But, some of the forecast amounts I'm seeing are up to an inch, especially if you get just south of Grand Rapids.
I'm not going to quit watering my trees in my garden. All right, Bob. As always, it's edifying and entertaining. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Up next, we've got local news, and then we're going to be talking about bees and wasps.
Mm-hmm. For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. A Saginaw man died in a motorcycle crash Friday night near Twig. The St. Louis County Sheriff's Office identified him as 56-year-old William Helgemo. In a news release, the sheriff's office says the motorcycle was eastbound on Industrial Road and failed to navigate a left-hand turn, overturning in a ditch. Helgemo was pronounced dead at the scene. The Black Duck City Council has agreed to disband its police force. The council unanimously rescinded an ordinance that established a police force in favor of a contract with the Beltrami County Sheriff's Office last week. Councilmember Lori Hamilton made the motion during the June 8th meeting, as much as she said she hated to see the Black Duck Police Department go.
But we can't just let it sit stagnant either, and it's kind of where we're at. I loved having a person here. I loved it for the kids. It built a better community.
The city had budgeted for a full-time police chief and a full-time patrol officer for years, but the positions had lately been filled only part-time by Beltrami County Sheriff's deputies. The council hosted a public hearing on the pending decision in March with presentations from the sheriff's office. The council also discussed what terms they would like to see in the contract, the presence of sheriff's deputies in the schools and at the Black Duck branch of the Bemidji Area Boys and Girls Club, and next steps for Black Duck's owned police vehicles. The current and former Minnesota state flags are now flying in Itasca County. Megan Buffington has more.
The Itasca County Board decided last month to fly both flags after 3 weeks of consideration. County Administrator Brett Skiles initially told the board the county would need to order two new flagpoles, but the flags ended up being displayed above Northeast 5th Street and what was the Sheriff's Office entrance on the backside of the county offices. Skiles says it was his decision to fly the flags there. The poles were previously used as part of a memorial that has since been moved to the city's main intersection. So, did the county end up spending any money on this?
Not a penny, nope.
The former state flag remains on display in the back corner of the county boardroom.
Board never discussed that flag, so it's just staying where it is.
Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
Flock Safety's network of automatic license plate readers continues to spread across northern Minnesota. The Brainerd Dispatch reports the Crow Wing County Sheriff's Office installed 10 of the AI-assisted cameras within the last year, with plans to install more in the near future. According to Minnesota Department of Public Safety records, Itasca County has 19 such devices, and the Paul Bunyan Drug Task Force installed 10 more around the Bemidji area within the last year, bringing its total to 22. The dispatch reports Crow Wing County shares its Flock data with all other users within the Flock system and is, quote, looking to limit their shared data to only other agencies in the state. Flock has contracts with law enforcement agencies across the country, including at the federal level. Minnesota statute requires data from license plate readers to only be shared within the state, plus other stipulations about how long data can be stored. The readers operate by snapping photos of vehicles and license plates each time they pass. State statute prohibits agencies from keeping the data longer than 30 days unless the photos are part of an investigation. The license plates recorded are compared with agency hot lists maintained by the State Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which could include stolen vehicles and vehicles connected with Amber Alerts. In the eastern U.S., where these cameras have been in play for many years, cities and towns are making moves to end contracts like these over concerns about rights to privacy. Flock Safety has come under intense scrutiny in Illinois over violations of the state's data sharing laws, with instances of immigration authorities accessing Illinois readers, as well as out-of-state agencies pursuing women seeking abortions in states where it's still legal. The Red Lake County baseball team adds another trophy to its shelf. The defending Class A state champions claimed second at this year's tournament. The Rebels fell to the number one seed Medelia on Monday at Target Field. Fellow Northland Class A team Southridge finished the tournament in fourth. Grand Rapids earned consolation runner-up in the 3A tournament. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. And sign up for the Buzz newsletter for the week's best stories and audio from this community radio station. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Local news from our region, it's the Up North Report. You can sign up for a podcast at kaxc.org.
We receive support from Oak Hill Assisted Living in Grand Rapids, providing personalized care in a home setting. More information at oakhillseniors.com. And we receive support from the Northland Foundation, working within Northeast Minnesota, offering grants, small business supports, and programs to help people and communities working toward a future where everyone feels they belong and can thrive. More at northlandfdn.org.
I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer, and today we continue our conversation about the natural world and our series on critters that use dead and declining trees in the forest. The series produced by Mark Jacobs, and today we are featuring Thea Evans. She is the project coordinator for the Minnesota Wood Nesting Bee Atlas, and we'll be learning more about bees and wasps in the forest. Thea, thanks for being with us, and Mark, thanks for joining us via phone.
Thanks, Heidi.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Mark. Morning, Thea. Nice to see you both. Well, I don't see you, Mark, but I know what you look like, so you're in my head. Yeah.
Well,
renting space.
Thea, let's start off with, what is the Minnesota Wood Nesting Bee Atlas?
The Minnesota Wood Nesting Bee Atlas is a citizen science project. We're dedicated to learning about the bees that nest in dead wood and plant stems. Our goal is to learn about where these bees live in Minnesota and what their habitat needs are. And we're currently working on several projects that are funded by a grant from the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund.
Very cool. Citizen science. So who's involved and how does one get involved?
Yeah, this is a statewide program. So we have volunteers all over the state who are working on this project with us. It started in 2016. And we have these bee blocks that we send to people all over the state, and they hang them out in a natural or semi-natural area. And then they monitor them for the nesting activity of bees and wasps that come to nest in them. And then they can log that information on our website, and we learn about where the different bees live and what their phenology is. So like what time of year they're active, what kinds of nest parasites might be interacting with them, all sorts of interesting stuff. And we have a website, which is minnesotabeeatlas.umn.edu. And that is a great place to find more information about the project. And it has a lot of information about our results so far, and also about future potential volunteer opportunities.
Now, is that, just to be clear, that's Minnesota Bee Atlas, all one word, and Minnesota is written out? It's not MNB Atlas, it's Minnesota Bee Atlas.
Yeah, that's
okay,
right.
Okay, good. All right. Well, then we'll have that up on our website, too, for those of you who are interested. A few years ago, we talked to a woman about bees, and I was alerted to the fact that red elderberry, if you cut the branches, trim the branches, that the bees will use those. And I did that, and the bees did use them. Just one example, but those are live trees, and you're talking about dead trees. Would it be the same sort of bees that are using elderberry as a place to lay their egg? Or are there different? I know there are thousands of different kinds of bees. It's a bit daunting when you get into it.
Yeah, we do have a really diverse bee population. We have about 500 species of bees just in Minnesota. And the bees that would nest in like cut elderberry stems, and they'll nest in other types of cut stems as well, are small carpenter bees usually. There are some others that will as well. And they really like the plant stems that have some pith in the middle, and they kind of construct the inside of the nest with that plant pith. They don't tend to nest in dead wood. So there's kind of a different set of bees that would be nesting in the dead wood.
And can you describe some of those? I mean, what would I be looking at if I were seeing a bee in dead wood? And are these like standing trees, or do they care if the tree blows down? Is that as good a home for them?
Yeah, there are, you know, many different species, and as well as the bees that nest in deadwood, there's an equal or maybe larger number of wasps that also nest in deadwood. So the different species have different habitat requirements, and they, you know, different places that they like to nest. So on the bee side, we have many species of leafcutter bees, many mason bee species, little tiny yellow-faced bees often nest in deadwood. So there are quite a few different types of bees, ranging from really tiny to pretty big. Some of them like to excavate into rotting wood, and they'll kind of dig their own nest tunnel into rotting wood. Some of them like fresher wood, and they'll rely on a tunnel maybe that's made by another insect, wood-boring insect, into that wood. So kind of having different, different deadwood and different stages of decay is helpful for the different species. It can be dead branches on living trees that they might utilize. It could be standing dead trees. It could be logs on the ground. And all of those could be habitat for bees or wasps, and different species of them.
You've mentioned bees and wasps a couple of times now, and I feel as though I might know the difference, but how would just a person who is maybe not familiar with them recognize one from the other? Is there, how do I know that's a bee and that's a wasp? Or is it not that simple?
They're really closely related.
Yeah, so they are.
Bees evolved from wasps, and they tend to be a little hairier. That's one way that people often distinguish them. It's not always true. There are some bees that aren't very hairy, and some wasps that are a little more hairy, but that's one way. But I think the main difference is that bees collect pollen and nectar, and that's what they feed to their young. And wasps are predators, so they collect usually other types of insects or arthropods, so often caterpillars or aphids or spiders.
I was going to say spiders, yeah. I saw a wasp take a spider one day and drag it across the sand and I suppose lay an egg in it or something and hope to feed its young. Yeah. So those, if it's predatory, it tends to be more likely a wasp than a bee.
Yeah, for sure. Bees are only collecting pollen and nectar. Adult wasps will visit flowers for the nectar for themselves. And there are some pollen collecting wasps also, but for the most part, what they're collecting to feed their young are other insects and arthropods.
So let's say I started this, joined the group and said, yeah, I want to do, but I don't know, I don't have a good book on bees and wasps. What do I do? Take a picture and send it to you guys and you'll go, oh, that's that wasp or that's that bee. Is that how that works?
Well, I love it when people take pictures and send them to us. I can't promise that we can totally identify it from a picture, but you can also, it's great to take pictures and post them to iNaturalist. You can often get pretty good identifications that way.
Right.
There's a Minnesota Bee Atlas project on iNaturalist. And a lot of really experienced bee identifiers go through that project and identify bees. So that's a pretty great place to post your pictures and learn about what you're seeing. It is pretty difficult often to identify bees and wasps to species just from a photograph. There's some exceptions. Bumblebees can be a little bit easier to identify that way. I often, you know, if I was looking at a picture, I might be able to say it's, you know, it's in this kind of group of bees. This is a leafcutter bee or this is a mason bee or that kind of thing.
We did just get a text in from Chris. She said, I have cedar posts around my garden. If I drill holes in it, will bees be interested?
That's very likely that they will be interested. Yeah, they're drilling holes in posts can definitely attract bees that like to nest in those tunnels. And that could be great for your garden, you know, and it may, you also may get some of those solitary wasps nesting in there. And they're the solitary wasps that nest in those kind of tunnels are also very gentle, just like the solitary bees, and they will, you know, provide some pest control in your garden. Yeah. So they're also really beneficial insects to have there.
Yeah. So can you talk about, well, the one I'm familiar with is, well, I don't know if it's it was a leaf cutter because I was cutting up 100-inch logs into firewood and splitting them. And I split one, and in there about 2 inches deep in the wood was this little plug of green material, which I took to be leaves. And so I'm sure I upset somebody's home, but, what sort of bee or wasp can you describe some of the common ones that might be out there?
Sure. That definitely sounds like a leaf cutter bee nest that you found in the log, which is pretty neat. The leaf cutter bees are, they're generally kind of medium sized bees. They can get on the bigger side, but kind of medium to big bees. And they collect pollen on the underside of their abdomen. So if you see them out and about at flowers, they will often have like bright yellow or bright white kind of pollen all over their underside of their abdomen, which makes them really kind of easy to pick out. Otherwise they're kind of stripey, like a, you know, like a bee.
Right.
And
warning.
Warning. Yeah. And so that's the leaf cutter bees are one type. Mason bees are out in the early spring. So we usually start seeing them in even as early as April, May, June, and they're usually done nesting by June. They are kind of this metallic dark blue or blue green color generally, and they're usually pretty fuzzy as well. And they can be, we have the orchard mason bee, which is a pretty big, it's a pretty good sized bee, but I guess in the range of bees, it's probably medium sized. And then there are a number of smaller ones that can be pretty small, but they still have that like kind of metallic blue-green sheen to them. They also collect pollen on the underside of their abdomen as well. So that's another kind of way to distinguish them, but they'll be active earlier in the season than the leaf cutter bees. The leaf cutter bees tend to be out in midsummer. The yellow faced bees are really tiny bees. They almost look like little tiny flying ants. They're mostly black. But if you can look at them, if you can get up close enough to them, you can see that they have these really distinctive triangular, yellow marks on their face. And and they don't have very much hair on them at all. So that's another thing that makes them look more sort of ant-like or wasp-like. But you would tend to see them on the types of flowers that have really open petals, maybe umbel-shaped flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. There are the wasps that might nest in deadwood are often potter wasps, so they're going to collect mud to build the inside of their nest, and they look a lot, they're in the same family as like yellow jackets and hornets, so they kind of look like that. They're yellow and black, and they have that waspy look to them, but they're solitary wasps. They're quite gentle, and there are many, many species of them.
You've mentioned now a couple of times that many of these bees are, when you say gentle, when I talk to people, I tell them these bees don't sting. These are not the kind of bees that are going to sting you. Is that what you mean when you say gentle? Are most of these bees not equipped with stingers or just reluctant to sting you?
Yeah, that is what I mean. They are reluctant to sting you. They do have stingers. The females have stingers. The males don't. So the females can sting, but they are really not interested in stinging. So they're when I say they're solitary bees, that means that each female mates and builds her own small nest that maybe has like 1 to 15 eggs in it. And she's doing all the work of that nest building. She's gathering the material to make the nest. She's guarding the nest entrance. She's laying the eggs. She's gathering all the food that she's going to feed to the babies. So she's, if something happens to her, that's it. She doesn't have any workers to like help her out. So she's really not interested in conflict or stinging. She'll just avoid you as much as possible. I've held these kind of solitary bees in my hand without being stung. They're very, the only time I think they would sting is if you kind of put your hand on them in a way, like if you accidentally put your hand down onto them,
right?
They might sting you.
I got stung by a bumblebee once when I stepped on one, but other than that, I can't ever remember being stung by a bumblebee. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, see, I was involved in your project for several years, and I just wondered, what have you learned from it, from the Citizen Science Project? Anything surprising or?
Well, we've learned a lot about, we started out not even knowing exactly what species were in Minnesota or where they lived within the state. So we were able we've been able to really map out where some of the different species live and see, like, there are some species that kind of range over the whole state. There are some that are really concentrated in one part of the state. We were able to document several new species that we didn't know were here. So that was pretty exciting. Several of them were bees that had previously only been known in areas a little bit south of here. So we don't know whether they had always been in Minnesota, but they were kind of rare and nobody had found them before, or if they are moving north as the climate warms. We've also learned quite a bit about their nesting biology. So we've learned a lot about the different interactions that happen within the nest. There are, along with the nest building bees and wasps, there are also many, many species of parasitic wasps and parasitic bees actually too. And they're a normal part of the bee and wasp community. So we've been able to learn some things about those relationships, which has been really interesting. There was actually a student at the university who started a project looking at cuckoo wasps and their hosts using the data from our project, which was really cool. And that project has continued. There's a whole class around that now, kind of looking at that data. They found some new species. They've been able to show that there are really specific host and parasite relationships. So that's been pretty neat.
Yeah, it sounds like it. What can I do as a homeowner that will help these bees and wasps?
Well, the main thing I think is to leave some dead wood in the landscape. And that could be dead branches or standing dead trees. My parents actually, they had a pine tree that died. It was near their garden, and they, instead of cutting the whole thing down, they just kind of cut the big branches off of it and left the main trunk standing. And that trunk stood for probably 15 or 20 years.
Hmm.
And then it started to get a little unstable, and they cut it down and left the logs lying on the ground. And when the logs were lying on the ground, you could see that it was inhabited. All the sections of that big trunk of the pine tree were inhabited by these green sweat bees that were making nests in the log.
Nice.
So it was, it was this incredible bee habitat. So if you have an opportunity like that to leave a dead tree in the landscape, I think that that can be really beneficial. Or, you know, if it feels like it's safer, it makes more sense to cut a section and leave some dead wood as a log instead, that's also great. And then the other kind of main thing is to plant flowers for the bees. So the bees, as I said, they really rely on pollen and nectar. And there are so many different species of bees. They're active at different times of the season. So having flowers blooming